The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time for us to return once again to the January 2020, or 2020 if you prefer, edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been Four Perfect Winter Weekends. We covered the pictorial the first week of January. We covered three of the four weekends the second week. We're going to do the last weekend today and some other stuff. And then we're going to get to the latest in the decades series. We're going to hit the 1960s, my decade. So I'm happy about that. I don't mean the decade I was born, the decade I remember growing up in. Anyway, we're going to get started with our perfect winter weekend, Lucky Pennies of the Sea. Do you know what that means, Lucky Pennies of the Sea? I don't know why they called it pennies. You'd think they'd call it Lucky Dollars of the Sea. In the off-season, Swansboro boat captain Darrell Marsh ferries intrepid shell seekers to the quiet slips of beach where a bonanza of sand dollars and other treasures wait. Darrell Marsh is one for quieter seasons. In the hectic summer, he loads his skiff with vacationers at Dudley's Marina in Cedar Point and pilots them through the winding backwaters past the Hammocks Beach Landing and over to Bear Island. There, locals and tourists from many states away compete with each other to find shells. The bounty is there, but it's spread among many. Winter's brisk temperatures and blustery winds may slow business, but Darrell knows that the off-season opens another door to sand dollars. Lots and lots of sand dollars. Because when the tide is out and competition is low, more treasures may be found by those who know where and when to look. You've got to be willing to be cold and wear lined boots, he says, as he prepares to pilot his skiff toward Bear Island on this crisp and clear day. But you wouldn't believe what you can find. For summer beachcombers, finding a whole sand dollar can feel as impossible as seeing the flip of a mermaid's tail. But the advent of winter changes things. The wind off the winter coast, intracoastal waterway blows over the beaches and inlets, bringing a deep sense of quiet and a welcome solitude that remains unbroken until the Easter crowds return. For shell seekers with grit and pluck, this is prime time to find Scotch bonnets and whelks, too. There's less competition out there because it's a sturdy person who beachcombs in January, says Terry Kirby Hathaway, a marine education specialist with North Carolina Sea Grant, who seeks shells year-round in Southern Shores where she lives. But also the waves are usually stronger, so that means more stuff might get brought up from the deep. Captain Darrell, as he's known, has been traversing the waters of the Crystal Coast for 13 years, first for pleasure and now as a part-time tour guide through his business, Marsh Cruises. He and his fiancée settled in Swansboro nearly two decades ago after seeking a quieter existence on the coast, which they found in the colonial port town. Now she runs a home decor shop on Front Street, and he takes summer renters and locals alike out for cruises. Adults look for shells, kids explore tidal pools. On this off-season outing, his only crew is a silver Labrador named Buxton. Darrell pulls in his lines, and we fall in with other boats headed out. The engine maintains its low but but and a satisfying thump. Daryl lies down at our feet. We clear the no-wake zone. Daryl throttles up, and the breeze turns into a welcome wind that beats at our skin, clearing away the funky smell of the marsh grass and replacing it with brisk salt air that feels primal, even ancestral. We pass by Brown's Island, and Daryl points to a sandbar on the bare island side, just revealed by the tide. "Nice and low," he says of the water. "And there's no one else out there. That's a good thing." Buxton goes to the bow. He knows what's coming. As soon as Daryl slows the throttle and gives the dog the go-ahead, Buxton leaps from the boat into barely a foot of water, stirring up the sand into watery clouds that mask what might be below. Daryl laughs and shakes his head. "You're not making it easy, Buxton," he says. As we splash through calf-deep water, eyes focused on sand, Daryl explains the serendipitous nature of shell-seeking. While it's important to hit the right spots when the tide is low, there's no predicting what you'll find. The capricious nature of the pursuit is part of its magic. "I've had people come back with 50 sand dollars out here," he says, "and then we come back out the next day and nothing." A sand dollar found on the North Carolina beach is a species of keyhole urchin, which is not as romantic as a moniker, but it's more to the point. The sand dollars that we're searching for are exoskeletal creatures called Melita quinquis perfectorata, which are scattered down the east coast from Virginia to the coast of Brazil. When alive, they're brown, and their skeleton, or test, is covered in a skin with tiny spines that help them burrow into the sand. They eat a primordial contraption called Aristotle's lantern, 5 calcium carbonate teeth that, when broken out of the sand dollar's test, resemble tiny white doves. Some see spiritual meaning in those doves, as well as in the sand dollar's 5 holes, which observant Christians say represent the 5 wounds of Christ on the cross. Others consider them coins dropped in the ocean by mermaids, or currency from the lost city of Atlantis. Still others think that finding a sand dollar, like a face-up penny, brings good luck. Terry is more likely to argue that a good winter storm will bring luck, for shell seekers anyway. Strong currents can toss whole shells up from the deep. I was out in March one year when there were hundreds of heart urchins, which are related to sand dollars, she says, but they look like popcorn when washed ashore. She encourages beachcombers to look past the lure of sand dollars and scotch bonnets and to consider the beauty of a more common species, too. Take a plebeian oyster shell, for example. Many would toss it aside, but Terry notes you might be throwing back a 12,000-year-old fossil. Most oysters do not live in the ocean. They do better in lower salinity, she says. But as the barrier islands move, they're uncovering oyster shells. So the lowly oyster shell that everybody thinks, it's just an oyster shell, is really a fossil just lying out there on the beach that nobody thinks is cool except for me. "And now you," she says, laughing. In less than an hour, Daryl, Buxton, and I found 9 sand dollars, which Daryl carefully wraps in paper towels and stores in a complimentary blue Marsh's cruise bag. We board his skiff again and putt-putt away from the shores, where a boat carrying a single angler has run aground and is being pulled by a rescue squad. "Great winter drum fishing out there," Daryl says. "Beyond those shoals, the waters darken as it slows into the open Atlantic. Our last stop before heading back to Dudley's Marina is just a narrow stretch of beach on a tiny island just past the Hammocks Beach ferry landing. Maybe 100 yards long, it's Daryl's place to find fossilized shark teeth." The hunt thrills his youngest passengers, many of whom, by this point in the trip, are ready to be off his skiff and back on land. Buxton leaps off the boat and tears down the shoreline, and we set to hunting. "Look for little pointy black shapes," Daryl says, eyes scanning the sand. "There," he says, "you see?" But I don't. He draws a circle in the sand, but all I see are broken shells reflecting the late afternoon sun. Darrell bends down and plucks off the ground a tiny ebony triangle no bigger than a fingernail, a fossilized shark tooth dropped in the ocean floor possibly tens of thousands of years ago and deposited onto this beach at the whim of a vacillating Atlantic tide. He rubs the tooth between his fingers to clean off the sand and hands it to me. "See," he says, and smiles. "Now you know what to look for." The water laps at my feet, and I keep searching. Kate Doty is a journalist in Raleigh. She's writing a book about her tenure as a weddings writer for the New York Times. Now, if you're interested in a shelling tour with Marsh Cruises and you have boots and warm clothes, I added that, call 910-330-8750 or book online at marshcruises.com/cruises-tours. And now let's meet the lady beetles. A quiet winter weekend getaway to the Jackson County woods is interrupted by a family of noisy neighbors. It's not exactly a British invasion, but these cute little critters have taken cabin culture by storm, written by Jared Misner. As I sit on the back porch of my weekend cabin in Silva, overlooking the bare and foggy forest below, I sip a glass of wine and enjoy the quiet solitude of the woods. Or rather, I try to. Instead of hearing a babbling stream or the soft rustle of leaves when I close my eyes and rock back and forth on the porch swing, all I hear is a faint but persistent dink, dink, dink coming from inside the cabin. I soon learn that my housemates and I aren't the only ones who've made a home for the weekend in this three-story mountain getaway, each floor decorated with a collection of playful black bear figurines, wolf paintings, and quilts tacked on wood-paneled walls. As it turns out, the hundreds of ladybugs in here have an appreciation for North Carolina cabin culture, too. As the dinking continues, I go inside, and I find dozens of slow-moving, slightly dazed ladybugs, correct term, lady beetles, recovering from flying full throttle into our cabin's ceiling light. The dinking, it seems, is the sound of the insect's tiny, round exoskeletons colliding with the glass. It's a problem that the cabin's owners warned us about. A binder in the kitchen that contains essential information like emergency phone numbers and the Wi-Fi password devotes almost 4 pages to the multicolored Asian lady beetle, compared to only 2 pages on trash disposal and preventing bears from accessing said trash. Sample warning, ladybugs are a way of mountain life. Unfortunately, they will find their way into the cabin. It happens every year in western North Carolina. Not that we mind sharing our cabin with lady beetle friends. They aren't roaches, flies, or mosquitoes, after all. They're not disease-carrying vectors. There was a particularly cantankerous one in a popular children's book, but even the grouchy ladybug became ungrouchy by the end of the story. So when a ladybug falls onto our arms from a mid-flight collision with a lamp or whizzes past our faces as we brush our teeth, we don't swat it away. We'd have to be some kind of monster to kill a ladybug, right? We're not going to eradicate them, Hannah Burrick, a professor of entomology at North Carolina State University, says of the ladybug invasion in the cabins of western North Carolina. They're going to be out in the environment, and they're going to find some nice, cozy space like your attic. And really, who could blame a bunch of ladybugs for flying in from the cold and snuggling up in a warm cabin for the winter? Barrick says that the insects cluster together during the cold season, which is why we're sharing our mountain cabin with hundreds of lady beetles and not just one or two. In essence, we've disturbed the winter slumber of a metaphorical den of bears, except that these creatures are way cuter than bears. We see them in cabins in the fall and winter because the space was probably unoccupied, Burrick says, and then you turn the heat on. The reason they're moving around is that someone has come in and woken them up a little bit. The multicolored Asian lady beetle was introduced to the United States in 1916 as a biocontrol agent in California's farmland, and later in North Carolina to control populations of a variety of pests, including crop-eating aphids. It wasn't until the 1990s and early 1900s, though, that North Carolinians started to notice lovelinesses. That's the adorable and proper term for large clusters of the bugs in cabins and homes. People would get annoyed that there were hundreds and sometimes thousands, says Burke, who remembers her grandmother vacuuming up ladybugs after turning the heat on for the season. What brought on the latest beetle boom? That's less clear. It's one of those things we have to take our best guess with, Burke says, noting that it could have stemmed from changing weather patterns or an increase in the populations of different aphid species. Whatever the reason, it's hard for us to dismiss the rouge-hued bugs in our cabin as pests. The lady beetles aren't here to harm us, after all. They merely came in from the cold, just as we did. We choose to share our cabin with them, cozying up together until warmer weather arrives. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service, and if you have any comments on our program, please call the studios 919-832-5138. And now we're going to go to the front of the magazine and read some of the smaller stuff in the what I would call the columns that they have each month. And one of those columns is entitled Welcome Home Downtown. And where we're going today is Gastonia. This rapidly growing city is attracting new fans who are weaving together past and present in former mills and old theaters, written by Jody Helmer. Jim Marasso had lived in Charlotte for 30 years and never ventured to nearby downtown Gastonia. When a friend suggested that Marasso consider opening his next restaurant there, he balked. Many of the things that I had heard about downtown in the past were not flattering, he recalls. I'm so glad I looked outside of my comfort zone. After his first visit in 2014, Marasso renovated the 1927 Webb Theater and opened Webb Custom Kitchen. Today, he's one of several visionaries committed to turning downtown into a major destination. You start to find each other and inspire each other about what could be, he says. Once you get on that path, you start working toward making it happen. And now we have a bunch of little shorts here, which talks about the various components, if you will, or attractions in Gastonia. Front page, it's a city street. We see here, I would say, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7-story building and some lower buildings. And we see trees on both sides of the road, parking on one side of the street, and occasionally on the other as it dips in toward a very wide sidewalk. And there's a pointer to something that's on the right-hand side, and we only see the very front of it. It says, the Esquire Hotel and Barrister Restaurant, the latest downtown development project, the historic Lawyers Building, includes a 35-room boutique hotel and a restaurant serving Southern cuisine with a twist. It's gone from urban blight to beautiful, Marasso says. By the way, there are some statistics down at the bottom of this page. It says the population of Gastonia is 77,000. The median age is 38.5. It has received 3 All-America City Awards. And the historic nickname of the city is, think, those of you who may have lived in that area, Spindle City. History Reimagined, a 600,000-square-foot 1902 textile mill, once the largest in the South, underwent a dramatic transformation to become the Loray Mill Lofts and Shops, a residential, retail, and cultural hub in downtown Gastonia. The project has drawn residents from bigger cities like Charlotte who are eager to take advantage of downtown living. We see a brick building here. It is 5 stories tall, and then there's a little tower in the front which goes up higher. I don't think it's an elevator tower because I think it's a portico that you can drive underneath, but it wouldn't surprise me if that's a stairway with windows on 3 sides in that tower, and then maybe you can go up to the top and there's a little observation area or something like that. How about eating? Webb Custom Kitchen. When I walked into the historic theater for the first time, it was run down and had an odd scent. But I looked at it and could visualize immediately how to bring out its beauty, Morasso says. He preserved the spirit of the theater, displaying vintage projectors and using film strips as artwork. Banquettes in the balcony are the perfect spot to watch classic movies while tucking into dishes like skillet-seared jumbo scallops. Boy, does this look good. There's a bowl here. It's like a wide soup bowl, and it's got some kind of bean or corn or maybe some kind of thick rice base, which is yellowish, and then there are 4 absolutely delicious-looking scallops placed on the top of it. Spindle City Cafe. Sandwiches and salads take center stage at this opera house turned casual eatery. Morasso describes the creativity to make this transformation as a great example of a young couple working together to feed our community. The theme, he adds, is an important nod to the city's history as a textile mill. Shop Hive Design. Beekeeper Merryman Castle specializes in monogrammed gifts ranging from stationery to porcelain to barware. All the wooden keepsake boxes and porcelain dishware are made and monogrammed in-house. Head to the back of the store to see woodworker Magic Jim and other artisans at work. Ford Seed and Plants. This homegrown garden center has been a downtown staple since 1920. It's the best place to buy heirloom plants and seeds by the pound, Morasso says. The old-fashioned store has such charm, it's an attraction in its own right. Gaston Pickers. The booths at the sprawling antiques mall are filled with curated collections of items from the past. Browse rarities like Elvis lamps and rotary dial telephones, plus trendy decorative items. Hello, vintage typewriters. And drink. Cavendish Brewing Company. Owner Scott Cavendish is a mad scientist, expert brewer and pioneer who puts out many outstanding beers, Morasso says, like the award-winning Elder Thing Farmhouse Ale and Grizzly Brown Ale. The former car dealership also hosts yoga classes, trivia nights, and bingo. And we have a picture of the inside here of the restaurant. It's taken from a balcony on the second level where there are some booths where people are seeing. Lots of light. You've got some very interesting windows here, kind of translucent, but they seem, I believe they are windows, and they curve way up to the ceiling, or maybe there's just, they could be just lit from behind. But we're looking down at some tables down below and a round banquette in the corner, and the kitchen is on the left-hand side, and there's some kind of a stage way up high. We see a little bit over the kitchen, that is. We see a projector screen that's been lowered, and we see a projector housed in a box on the opposite wall. The place that the people, this was an old theater, I guess, is what they said, and the place upstairs where people are eating and was obviously the balcony. They probably straightened it out the floor and got rid of the risers, and this box is kind of put where the stage lights might have been, and it must project onto that screen. On the other hand, there's an old-fashioned spotlight that would be manually operated sitting up there next to the projector, so you can project things in the other direction also. And now Durham, under the moniker Welcome Home Shopkeep, fashion statement. A downtown boutique has made a name for itself through its mission to be mindful about clothing and community. Joramites pack into the spaces between racks of designer jeans, sweaters, and dresses at Vert and Vogue. They come to this upscale boutique for clothes and accessories made with natural fibers by small-scale designers. But on the third Friday of every month, they can also listen to short talks by the likes of restaurateur Andrea Rusing and scholars William Ferris and Marcy Cohen Ferris. Since arriving in Durham 11 years ago, owners Ryan and Nadira Hurley have become an integral part of the city's social fabric. They began the Happy Hour Speaker Series as a way to celebrate local luminaries, and members of their staff volunteer monthly with area nonprofits. It's all about relationships, Nadira says. We try to demonstrate care in all of ours. Vert and Vogue, 353 West Main Street, Durham, vertandvogue.com. There's a picture of them, a couple of them here. It says Vert, or Vert, the French word for green, reflects Ryan Hurley's passion for environmental advocacy, while Vogue is a nod to Nadira's experience managing clothing boutiques in Paris. Now, welcome home brewery, Mount Olive, Pickletown Pints. Wayne County's first brewery has embraced local culture with a special nod to the town icon. Order a flight at R&R Brewing in Mount Olive, and you'll receive your beers in an unusual set of glasses, pickle jars. Glance up and you'll see Edison light bulbs ensconced in pickle jars. Behind the bar, behind a giant plastic pickle donated by Mount Olive Pickle Company, owner Ryan Roberts sets out to create a truly local establishment when he founded the brewery in 2018. In addition to showcasing pickle pride, R&R donates 10% of proceeds from its farmhouse ale to the University of Mount Olive's agricultural program. And Robert buys his ingredients locally whenever possible. The result? A brewery that's of Wayne County, right down to the American-style beers they brew. Those IPAs with a super high bitterness level aren't going to appeal to a lot of the natives in this area, Robert says. We love our sweet tea. We love things on the sweet side. R&R Brewing, 541 Northwest Center Street in Mount Olive. R&RBrew.com. Invest in yourself and the future, says the ad. FTCC, Fayetteville Technical Community College. They can be reached at www.fayetechcc.edu. Well, my friends, that is all the time we have for today's episode of our State Magazine, and I certainly hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time we do that article on the 60s. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the communities of 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call us, please, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.